start a war, because the shape at those frequencies may not be advantageous anymore. In other words, circular turns at 1.5 gig isn't necessarily a great shape. That's a great geometric shape for 30 meg, maybe even pushing it up to 100 meg. You know, but even then, at 100 meg, you know, circular coils start, you know, they make better chokes than they do couplers. Yourself?
If I was winding that coil at 1.5 gig on a toroidal material, I guess what you're about to say is that with the mu getting kind of low and the frequency getting kind of high, I'm going to get a lot of leakage reactants, and a significant amount of the flux that I'm generating will not necessarily be inside of the ferrite material. Is that true?
Right on, because you're going to be way off. If you look at volts per turn and cross-sectional area, you're going to be way off the scale. So it's not going to really, the loss is going to be in the material. But here again, you know, like I know, if you're going to decouple a transistor, what does the decoupling coil look like to block the DC coming down off of the line for high impedance? It just looks like a little itty-bitty coil with a couple of turns on it. So what I'm saying is, like, the inductance of just the wire starts looking more like a choke in those geometries with circular, where if you start taking printed line on a ceramic substrate and you make a width of a line against a ground plane, and then you put another line, coupling line next to it, you can have a lot more fun that way with a lot better results, still using ceramic ferrite materials.
Yeah, two transmissions downrange, I'm going to ask you what you mean by ceramic ferrite materials. However, if the whole reason you're using toroids and ferrites is to make convenient balloning-like devices, push-pull transistors and things like this, if I'm not trying to get a whole lot of bandwidth, I don't necessarily need the ferrite. I can set up an inductor and a capacitor into a matrix-like topography, which gives me the center tap transformer-like characteristic, plus or minus 180 degrees or plus or minus 90 degrees. I can get that with L's and C's without using ferrite at a narrow band frequency. Wouldn't I be better off doing that when I'm up at UHF frequencies and avoid the ferrite in the first place if I'm at UHF? Over to you, Glenn.
Oh, I agree. There's much better techniques here again, but, you know, there's other techniques. What about a coupler? You know, you're going to make couplers, and you're going to make them broadband, and you want to use, and you don't want them, you know, or let's say even on HF, and you want to do a coupler that does, say, with less than 3 dB of ripple, and you want, 60 dB of directivity, and you want to go from 500 kilohertz to 30 megahertz, and you want to do it in something that's, like, less than a foot long. How do you do that? Ferrites can come in pretty handy, especially as a substrate and a strip line.
I'm going to give you that one. Okay. Lots of octaves in a small package. Mini circuits makes a lot of things like that. Now, when you're talking about ferrites and you're talking about ceramic ferrites, does that mean that the binder is ceramic? Where does the word ceramic and ferrite come together, Rick Lynn? Go ahead.
It just so happens that when you get into the higher frequency ferrites, the more stable materials to mix with the irons and the nickels and zincs, tends to be ceramic. So it's the binder, yeah. And they're pressed in very, very high temperature pressures, and they make tremendous binders and very, very stable for HF and medium VHF type devices.
2 weeks ago, when I was talking to Wesley, I was speculating that if he wanted to do lathe work on ceramic ferrites, that I strongly recommended he not do that, that his ability to cut a ferrite toroid in such a way that he changes any one of its dimensions without cracking it and have other kinds of failure, I think could be very, very difficult. I wonder if you see it that way. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, it's really hard to work with. I mean, you can order materials pre-gapped, like if you order them from like Arnold Magnetics or something like that, they'll pre-gap them for you. To do it yourself, I've done it in a pinch, you know, I've taken the file and you file it and, oh boy, and the four-letter words come out left and right. It can be done, but there's a lot of waste there, I think, yeah. It's very difficult to do. KC2QIQ.
You were just filing off round to round off corners or something like that. If you were trying to take a toroid and change the inside diameter or the outside diameter on a lathe, I'm not so convinced that the toroid would survive that. You know what they do in medicine, where, for instance, if you want to make extremely thin slicings of, let's say, for instance, a cadaver's brain, you freeze it and put it in a fancy machine that cuts it. And I wonder if there's a way you could take the ferrite toroid and put it into some kind of material which holds it together while you're doing the lathe work. But under ordinary circumstances, I don't think you could change the inner or outer diameter of a toroid on a lathe. I don't think it would survive. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, I definitely agree, Dick. And not only that, a lot of these, especially something like a 800 perm material, that's probably got some heavy iron in it, and without special coatings, it'll rust. The core will actually start rusting. So they usually put like some kind of like plastic or some other coating spray around the outside. And so even if you were 100% successful, chances are the thing will start rotting away on you. Number one, chances are if you put it into something that's going to start like a high-speed drill and the vibration of that, it's just going to shatter the minute you try to put it in the middle. And and even if you were successful, chances are you might actually just damage the coatings to the point that you're making it junk anyway. KC2QIQ.
When you were using a file on the ferrite material, my guess is it wasn't really coming off like it would if you were filing a piece of plastic. My guess is it was chipping in a funny way, that under a microscope you were seeing real surface failures in the place where the file made contact with the ferrite. Is that approximately true, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's basically it. See, but the type of transformer structure that I was doing that on was an E-core, and I was using like a, I think it was like a 1700 perm E-core, and basically what I was doing is I was taking center leg and with a file on the centerpiece. So even if a little bit of the center was chipping off, that's still a legitimate part of the gap. So it wasn't pretty, let's put it that way, but still I could gap the inductance the way that I wanted it to, and within that structure of the center piece of the E, and it was still effective, it would still work. But, not something you'd ever want to do in high volume or if you wanted a nice, pretty-looking structure, no way.
So you were grinding down the center post in order to make an air gap internal to an E-core in order to make a choke, which would have a little bit better saturation characteristics. Could you have ground that down on a grinding wheel?
Oh, boy, I've tried, and basically what happens is it glows red, and then it cracks, and then that's the end of that.
So even very careful grinding on a very fine grinding wheel with lots of stopping to cool it off, you're saying it might not survive that kind of mechanical operation?
When you apply water, it's not going to go red.
Well, I just can't imagine a high-speed stone and water and everything else. I mean, it sounds like a messy thing. Not impossible, but, they do it, Dick. I mean, they do gap stuff. And so, I mean, there's obviously got to be some kind of, like, water pressure and a high-speed grinding wheel that does it properly. So I'm sure it is a process that people do. Because, I mean, when you order gapped ferrite from transformer manufacturers, they are doing it. So it's just not an easy thing to do at home.
The lathe end with the carbide sharp carbide end on it, which is like a knife, they are very made from the powder, and they are very, very, very fragile to crack, but when you use them in lathe, they do the work. What you use is you use a diamond kind of grinder, and it does the work perfectly. I did it many times.
Okay, that's good to know. If I bought EI laminated, not laminated, EI lat core, where I want no air gap, and those interfaces that come together, I want them to mate extremely well. Some form of very fine grinding, lapping material was used. So there must be a way of doing grinding of fluoride materials that is safe and will give you a, what looks like a mirror finish. But I suspect that the materials you use to grind a telescope mirror and the materials you use to grind the ferrite to make a mirror finished lapped surfaces that are coming together, they might be very similar materials. What do you think, Glenn?
Yeah, I would have to agree, Dick. I mean, it's not an easy process. Here again, it's done, you know, all the time. Here again, that's like you're saying, it's got to be a very, very precision operation. And keep in mind, too, every time you're going to see, like, E-cores and those machine finishes, they're all machines, interestingly enough. I mean, there's only so much you can get out of a mold, but then the final finish is always a machine finish, Dick. KC2QIQ.
Comment?
Go ahead, John.
Yeah, Dick, the machine they use for that, it's a surface grinder, very accurate surface grinder, and it works well.
Are you using just the right kind of grinding compound with water?
I don't believe it's water. It's more like a glycol that they use, and the part of the abrasive particles are suspended in that glycol.
And I'm guessing those are extremely fine particles, measured in microns.
I don't know if they're in microns, but I know there were carborundum and some diamond dust. And also, for grinding, believe it or not, they use paper dust.
What in the world is paper dust, and why would paper attack something that's that hard?
If you research newsprint, what they use in a newspaper press, which I worked for many years, there's a high content of a very special clay. It's a white clay. And it is so abrasive, it will polish diamonds.
Are you telling me that I could take newspaper, and if I had enough time, I could rub it across the diamond and polish it?
Absolutely, Dick. You should see some of the trundle rods that we had on the press get polished with paper running over it for a few years. Right to the point where it takes a break.
If you say diamond end on the lathe, and you take, let's say, 1 micron, 2 microns, whatever you take out. Now, this surface will be shiny. So then the insulation that was made when the that powder was grinded and then bonded together actually makes the contact to the surface. My question was, do you disturb the structure of the ferrite at that time, making it conductive from the surface, or at any kind you disturb it? And if I remember correctly, your answer was no, you do not. So I would like to make sure that I understood it properly. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that's for you, Glenn.
Yeah, grinding and although I don't believe you're changing any of the real properties to any significant level. I think the only thing you have to be careful of, though, Wesley, is that on some of these materials, especially with higher iron content in them, if you take, like if you start machining the edge, if you see a coating on the outside, when you take that coating off, then it can start to rust. KC2QIQ.
Is there a coating material you know of you could replace the coating with after he's finished his machining operation?
Yes, Dick, any kind of like epoxy paint. Most paints will work. Anything that's like a rust-preservative type of paint.
I stop the rust from happening on my tower components by using zinc-rich paint. Would something as simple as that do the job?
I would think so, Dick. It's just basically the coatings that they put on the outside of the, you know, the more iron-based type of ferrites. You'd have to put something on them to prevent them from rusting. So pretty much anything, you know, you know, any kind of a good coating that's rust prohibitive should do it. You know, because, you know, iron exposed oxidizes very, very quickly.
In the case of a radio tower, you use zinc, hot dip zinc coatings and zinc-rich paint because the zinc becomes sacrificial during the rusting process, and therefore the rusting of the steel no longer takes place. Back to you, Glenn.
That's great stuff. I love it. That gray paint works wonders. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, nowadays they have some even better paint, but rust inhibiting, rust converting, and so on paint. They've come a long way with paint protection. In the early days, protecting magnesium was very difficult. Nowadays it's becoming easy.
Question. So wrong with rust? I mean, rust is an insulator as well. What's wrong with it?
Yeah, does anything bad happen when the surface of your ferrite starts rusting, other than looking ugly and maybe expanding and doing something terrible to your coil? Over to you, Glenn.
I'm going to give you some, this is experience telling you stories about this one. But here again, these were pieces of equipment that were produced by manufacturers that you would think would be really on top of their game. And what they basically did was they shipped stuff with ferrite materials on the inside that weren't properly coated. And they stayed out in the field for about 3 or 4 years, and literally the magnetic materials on the inside crumbled into dust. KC2QIQ.
Were those ferrite materials used as a transformer, as a coil? I mean, if it was a power transformer and it crumbled into dust, does that mean the primary and secondary no longer had any coupling? Over to you, Glenn.
The description that I heard was the they were in a site and they were working, and they were moved from the site and moved to a different site. They plugged them in and all the fuses popped. You get the idea.
Yeah, your primary winding is going to go down to an extremely small inductance, and therefore the amount of current it draws just from primary inductance could be huge. Is that approximately what happens?
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, and it's even dead if it happens in the output inductor. Because if you lose the output inductor, your ripple current of the capacitors that goes until the output, until basically the output capacitors just, you know, they fail and short. If it's on the input side of a power transformer, your inductance goes low, and basically there's no more coupling and just a short circuit on the input. So generally, you know, when the manufacturers of the power supply put an inductor or a transformer in there and it loses its properties, it's not going to be pretty. KC2QIQ.
So I understand that the rusty surface actually became conductive?
No, in his case he was saying it disappeared. However, if I had EI laminations, sheets of metal, in, you know, forward and reverse from layer to layer as the primary of a transformer, and if they weren't properly coated, and this is, let's assume that I got exposed to seawater, and now drastic rusting is occurring of each of the individual laminations of the EI core, and that rust starts expanding. My guess is it can create a failure of the coil from mechanical expansion. Is that true, Glenn?
Yeah, that's possible, but I'm familiar with the stuff you're talking about there. Those laminates, those are that material is actually called supermunder, and it's pretty tough. And I think what happens is that there's enough zinc and other materials inside there that even if it rusts, it kind of just turns into like a brownish kind of color, and it doesn't really go away. Where the ferrites are more iron, and the iron oxidation will literally just rot. I mean, and then the only thing that's left is the binder, and the binder just kind of collapses, and that's it just, you know, as I said, just a little bit of vibration, and the whole thing just pulls apart. But the supermunder that you're talking about, those are like steel laminates, and steel can get pretty rusty on the outside and still last quite some time. But yeah, the mechanical fit, you still have to make sure that it's all buttoned together nice and tight with its clamps. KC2QIQ.
In the case of the individual particles of a ferrite core, which previously were chunks of iron and maybe some kind of a alloy of iron and nickel and so on, and it starts rusting, is iron oxide no longer a ferromagnetic material?
Interestingly enough, Dick, sometimes it actually looks better. The iron oxide sometimes has some better performance than the iron by itself. So sometimes you wind up with, but what will happen is the integrity of the structure now becomes like a very, very delicate thing where if it rots on the inside, it could literally just collapse, just a vibration and vaporize, if you know what I'm saying. So I think as long as it stays together, it's just that the problem is the binder is what's really breaking down with the rust.
Are you telling Glenn that they're actually for a soak with water, like a sponge?
I think he's saying it rotted away, turned into powder, and disappeared. If the whole transformer had been properly potted in a solid block of epoxy, so at least all the particles are held in the right position while they are rusting and turning into iron oxide, is it possible that transformer in that situation could keep operating? Over to you, Glenn.
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, there are certain manufacturers, not going to mention their names, where they actually design those kinds of materials inside little, like, plastic encapsulations. And then other people use basically, like, paints and epoxies around the outside of their coatings to hold them together. So there's a lot of different ways of doing it, Dick, and to kind of support it and hold them together, and they'll work just fine. As a matter of fact, there's a material out there called Cool Mu, which is basically oxide aluminum that's kind of like rotting away aluminum, and it's held together in a binder and an encapsulant that holds it all together. Amazing stuff.
Is an oxide of aluminum a magnetic material I could make a transformer or an inductor out of?
Yes, it is. And if you're interested in looking it up, there's a company called, if you have a chance, go on the internet, type in Magnetics Inc., and look up Cool Mu, KOOL/MU. And you'll see a whole selection guide of toroids, and they have some E-cores,
in basically in aluminum oxide cores.
Up till now, I thought aluminum was a non-magnetic material. Where did I go wrong?
I'm not sure.
Okay. If I'm looking at the microscopic level of an iron-like particle, which has got lots of magnetic characteristics, and I allow the majority of that particle to become iron oxide, is iron oxide still a magnetic material? I'm beginning to think the answer is yes, because wasn't it essentially iron oxide particles that were put onto magnetic tapes? Over to you, Glenn.
I think we've got a problem with words here. Are we talking about magnet or magnetic materials? Magnetic materials, you basically need a conductor that's ground up and some spacing in between. Now, it could be ceramic, epoxy, binders, whatever, and you can make a magnetic material where you can increase the permeability greater than air. Now, if you want to make a magnet, okay, where you want, shorted dipole performance, aluminum ain't going to do it. KC2QIQ.
If I'm using aluminum oxide or aluminum particles, and I'm putting them in a coil, does the mu of that material end up greater than that of air?
Absolutely.
Okay. How come when I take my super strong neodymium magnet and put it against a bar of aluminum, it appears to do nothing?
Here again, if you take a piece of copper and you put it against your neodymium magnet, you probably see a similar performance, correct?
I sure do. To me, copper and aluminum appear to be materials that do not respond to a magnetic field. It appears as though they wouldn't be increasing the mu of a coil. Go ahead.
But what happens to them when you move them through a magnetic field?
Okay, their conductivity is going to give me eddy currents. I'm going to give you that. We used to have a tuning tool. It was a yellow plastic rod. You had a ferrite cylinder on one end. You stick it into a coil, and the coil would become more inductive. You had a brass slug on the other end. You stick it into the coil, and the coil would become less inductive. So the eddy currents of brass, copper, aluminum are going to lower the mu. I call them anti-magnetic materials when used in the presence of an AC field. Go ahead.
Okay, a magnetic material does not share the same exact principles as a magnet, if you follow me.
Okay, I think I would never get any attraction between brass, copper, aluminum, and my steady-state high mu magnet. In other words, a neodymium magnet, a really strong magnet. I can bring it near a slug of brass, a slug of copper, a slug of aluminum, and those slugs appear to be inert to the local magnetic field. As long as the magnetic field is steady state, yes, a changing magnetic field, I'm going to be setting up eddy currents. But that's different. Is there any real mu increase that I get out of aluminum or aluminum particles or aluminum oxide particles? Over to you, Glenn.
Okay, I see where the confusion is coming from. If you take a magnet, you know that the permeability of air is 1, right? Now, are you aware that the permeability of a magnet is also 1?
There, I know it's got very high retentivity. I establish by the process by which I built that magnet, I put it into an extremely strong magnetic field. A whole lot of flux lines flowed through that material. And when I brought away the external magnetic field, it was retained. So what you're saying is that because of its retentivity, I can't change easily the magnetic field within the material. Therefore, not only would it be a mu of 1, I think it could, in theory, be a mu of 0. Go ahead.
That's actually got another definition. That's a superconductor.
Okay, but if I'm using material with a high enough retentivity, unless I apply tremendous amounts of magnetic force, ampere turns I could call it, I'm not going to change the magnitude of the magnetic field within that material. So therefore it has a kind of permeability that's a hell of a lot lower than air, therefore a hell of a lot lower than unity. So to a changing magnetic field, which is the way you and I would measure mu, it is a mu that is much, much smaller than unity. Am I wrong on that one? Go ahead.
Partially. The material does not determine the magnitude of the magnetic field. It's basically the magnitude of the electrical current in the wire, the number of turns, and the proximity of the turns. What permeability is doing is it's not changing the magnitude of the magnetic field. It's basically controlling the path length direction. QSL?
Okay. If I'm plotting the magnetic field of a solenoid coil built in air, and I know where all the lines of magnetic field are going, I now take this magnetic material, a slug, and I put it down the center of my solenoid coil. An awful lot of those, because it has a mu that's much, much higher than air, let's assume it's got a mu of 100, it has a kind of magnetic conductivity, I'm going to call it, 100 times better than air, those lines of force are going to concentrate in that material. Correspondingly, if I was putting an AC current through that solenoid coil, the magnitude of the magnetic field inside of that mu of 100 material would be going up and down with the polarity of the current I'm putting on the solenoid coil. So the rate at which I can concentrate the magnetic field, you and I call that mu, and the mu, in order for it to be useful for an AC circuit, I have to be able to change it. It has to be a kind of electromagnetic material, not a steady-state magnetic material. That's my belief. Over to you, Glenn.
That's right. And what the reason that we want the magnetic field, the path length of the magnetic field, to be in line is because we want to couple from one winding to another winding. So when we want to create that coupling, we want to make sure that the lines of force are aligned in such a way that both coils are on the same magnetic layer if possible, or if we have to create a second or a third magnetic layer, that there's still enough magnetic field in that path length to couple. QSL?
I have a question in this area. How long, then, the rod of the ferromagnetic magnet material should be for the coils, with regard to the length of the coils, to be with the same field?
When you said the word coupling, Glenn, I think you're talking about coupling from primary to secondary, from winding to windings, or I'm talking about coupling within one single solenoid coil where I'm coupling into the individual turns. If the magnetic field properly couples to all of the turns, I get a lot more inductance per turn. Therefore, I'm getting more inductance per total solenoid. My whole solenoid has gone up in microhenries because I've added that ferrite core, and that's because I've got greater coupling of all of the turns of that solenoid coil, whether it be one coil or two separate coils, primary and secondary. After that, we're going to go into the length of the ferrite rod. But that one first, Glenn, go ahead.
Well, here again, just you've got the right idea, but the words we have to straighten out. The word coupling basically means from winding to winding. So that's a term, with transformers and magnetic devices. So in other words, in order to have coupling, you need more than one winding.
When you're talking about a single winding, there's no coupling. Now, what we're talking about here is an increase in of inductance associated to a core. You know, a core's relationship to an inductor. Now, what's happening there in that particular case is you have the permeability of the magnetic lines of force that are lined up in the path length of the windings. So what's happening now is the unit of inductance from winding to winding per turn is increased by n squared a sub l. So what's really happening here is you're unifying the path length to increase the inductance. Does that make sense?
Partially, but I'm going to back up now. If I've wound a solenoid coil where the length of the solenoid is extremely short, and I've got the right kind of magnetic material going down the center of the solenoid, under that circumstances, the inductance of my winding is primarily a function of turns squared. And the way they word that is that's true. The inductance goes up at turns squared if all of the flux links all of the turns of this one winding. But now, correspondingly, I wind my solenoid coil in such a way that it's got a very long length in the z-axis so that not all of the flux links all of those turns. My inductor no longer follows the n squared law of inductance. So coupling between the turns of a single coil, I mean, that coil of wire, I'm looking at coil number four, I'm looking at turn number four of the solenoid coil. He doesn't know whether or not he is all by himself the secondary of a second winding, or if he's turn number four of the first winding. In either case, how much voltage that gets developed across that coil by Faraday's law is only a function of the rate of change of magnetic field in that particular turn. So I think I can definitely talk about the coupling between turns of a single coil of a one winding solenoid. Over to you, Glenn.
I see where you're going, but it's not exactly like that. It's kind of a mathematical term. The n square rule always works. The problem is it's a numerical issue. What's happening is that the permeability of air is 1. So n squared times your a sub l of 1 is 1. So you basically just have the inductance over the line length. So that's what the problem is there. So it doesn't really matter whether it's just a straight piece of wire or a loosely wound coil, so to speak. It's not coupling between the windings. It's the problem is the a sub l. And the a sub l is too close to 1 to give you any kind of increased magnetic field between the wire turns to give you that effect. But now what's happening is once you put something in between that you can put turns around a cross-sectional area, yes, now you can get the increase in inductance by n squared a sub l. But keep in mind that the permeability is going to be determined also by the path length. So if you just have a bar and you have an open path length on both sides, the increase of permeability isn't going to be that large until you close it around the outside, like either with a toroid or some box shape, you know, some other eyepieces all put together to close the pathway.
Question. I'm going to follow Wesley's earlier question. Let's assume now I've got a solenoid coil that is 3 inches long. It's maybe got 50 turns to it, but it's a solenoid one-layer coil 3 inches long. I've got this beautiful rod of ferrite material. I'm going to slip down the center. My ferrite rod, let's assume my ferrite rod is 3 inches long. But I'm only going to slip it in 1.5 inches. Only half of the solenoid has the ferrite rod inside. The half that has the ferrite rod inside, if I add some turns to the solenoid in that area, I will come close to following the n squared law. Because the presence of the ferrite is concentrating the magnetic field there, and you could say all of the flux is linking all of the turns. In other words, all of the magnetic field is going down the center of all of those coils. If I go over to the left-hand side where I've got air and the ferrite rod is not there, the other 1.5 inches, I add some extra turns there, I will not follow the N-squared law on the exact same solenoid coil, because now the crazy magnetic field out there is not being concentrated. There is no ferrite rod out there. So the way the flux links the curves, links the turns, on the left-hand side versus the right-hand side of this particular solenoid coil is a function of how far I stick that rod down that coil. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
Here again, 90% there. When you're putting the ferrite in towards the first couple of turns of that coil, what's happening is you have a very well-defined permeability as it, you know, as it fits in there mechanically uniform across the first couple of turns. But just because those other windings on the bottom don't have, they're not directly in line with that material, they're still following the N-square rule. The difference is that their permeability is so low that, in other words, numerically, the increase is very small. So in other words, as I said, if the permeability is 1, N squared times 1 is 1. So you don't see a big numerical change. So it's, the N squared rule is still working. It's just how much permeability is being imposed upon the number of turns that you're sliding the ferrite through the coils. QSO?
Let's assume that the solenoid is parallel across the table. It's lying flat on the table. It's a 3-inch long solenoid, 1-inch diameter. And I've got a 1-inch diameter ferrite rod that's stuck in 1.5 inches. And I measure the inductance of the whole coil. And maybe it's 100 microhenry. And I add an extra turn to the coil in the area where the ferrite rod is located. And maybe I'll go from 100 microhenries to 101 microhenries. Now I take that turn back out. And instead, I add one extra turn on the left-hand side of the coil where there is no ferrite rod. I add one extra turn. Instead of going from 100 microhenry to 101, I only went to 100.1 microhenry. Is that a possibly realistic situation? Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole principle behind, like, slug tuning and things of that nature. But you can also have a similar effect also by putting it all the way through and then controlling the air gap on the outside. So in other words, you can close the path length of that magnetic field by closing the material around the outside of the coil. So in other words, like you basically box it in. So you've got the piece of ferrite running through the center of the coil, and then two I-beam pieces on either tip, and then an outside one closing parallel to the inductor on the outside. So now you've got a closed path length. Now you can also control that air gap and control the inductance. And then, so you follow what I'm saying. It's the permeability of the effect times N squared. So you can only get reached, let's say if the material is 2,500 perm. The only way you're going to get 2,500 perm is when the path length is closed, right, times its effective path length. So, and there again, as you make the path length shorter, in other words, if you make that boxed-in path length, LE, shorter, the inductance will also get higher.
Question.
I'm going to agree with you that when I get rid of more and more air and I close the path with ferrite, everything gets better and better. I got you to agree that when I added one turn in the area where there was a ferrite rod, I got a substantial increase in inductance. When I added one turn in the area where there was no ferrite rod on the exact same solenoid coil, I got very little change in inductance. My way of explaining that is that the presence of the ferrite rod in the good end of the coil is concentrating the magnetic field, and the way some people word that, it's not good wording, is that all the flux is linking all of the turns. The presence of the ferrite rod is concentrating the magnetic field down the center of the axis of that toroidal, of that solenoid coil in that area. Whereas if I plotted the magnetic lines of force of this long solenoid coil in the area where there's air, I get a whole lot of lines of magnetic field going off in crazy directions, no longer linking all of those turns out there. So linking of the turns of a coil because of the magnetic structure around it, is a factor on rate of change of inductance versus added turns. I could call that whether or not the flux is linking those curves, those turns. As I said, it's not good wording, but isn't that at least somewhat explaining the phenomena, the concept? Over to you, Glenn.
I completely agree with your concept. It's 100%. It's just that the wording that you'll find used in these kinds of structures is area, cross-sectional area, and permeability. So what you're describing here is that the more material that you're putting in of a fixed cross-sectional area with a permeability is affecting the flux lines of force in that area. And as you slide that cross-sectional area with a higher permeability through a larger number of coils, you will increase the overall permeability in the area of the coil. So it's kind of area and area length, half length, and cross-sectional area. So then what's happening is the lines of flux, or the field lines, are being reinforced due to improved permeability. So those are the words, but your concept is right on, Dick. KC2, QIQ.
Okay, this is the best of all worlds. I'd like to set up high permeability materials with high frequency capability, so that there's very little eddy currents in the materials. And I would like to close all of the paths, magnetically speaking, so that 99.9% of all of the lines of magnetic field are not flowing through air. They're all flowing through my high permeability material. I'm going to have a whole lot of concentration down the axis of the solenoid, and by all of the magnetic structure I put on the outside of the solenoid coil, I'm again closing that magnetic path. I'm now making a tall cylinder of a magnetic chunk of material that really is a form of a toroid. It's a very tall toroid instead of a fat toroid, so to speak. So if I can close all of the paths, magnetically speaking, so that every line of magnetic field flows down the center of every one of those coils, every one of those turns of the solenoid coil, and then flows out around the outside of this total structure, again flowing through ferrite material, nothing in air, I've now got the highest possible concentration of magnetic field. My coil will follow exactly, inductance is proportional to N squared. I'm going to get the highest amount of inductance per turn for that particular material. Wouldn't that be essentially the direction we're going if we're trying to make the most ideal inductor with ferrite-like materials? Over to you, Glenn, K2LAW.
Yes, but I just want to add one more thing. Keep in mind that the field is generated by the coil itself, because that's where the electrical currents are flowing through that wire. So the high B field is basically located right around the coil, because it's, you know, volt turns and cross-sectional area. That's what's going to determine your B. Now, so it's going to be focused right around that coil. The other side of the ferrite on the other end is relatively cold by comparison. So in other words, if you have a high flux field, you'll see the heat build up in that one area where the winding is on one side of that ferrite. That's where the heating is taking place, right there. Now, another interesting thing about this too is by increasing the number of turns, okay, you can bring the B field down and reduce the hysteresis losses for AC. So that's the other thing too, is to try to minimize the BAC to keep the losses at the lowest possible amount.
The reason I was wording it that way is that Wesley is about to start using an inner chunk of ferrite, toroid, and an outer chunk. He's slowly moving in the direction, I think, of having a concentrated magnetic field down the center of one set of solenoid windings, and by having an outer set of toroids on the outside of that, completing the magnetic path, he's going to end up with one of two things. First of all, maximum possible inductance of the first solenoid winding that I'm talking about. And if he has a secondary coil somewhere else, again, he has the capability by closing these magnetic fields with this closed structure of ferrite toroids of getting the greatest coupling, primary to secondary winding. Do you see where we're going on this one? Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
Yes, and the only thing with this a lot of times is that the magnetic lines are sometimes take a lot of analysis to figure out where exactly they're flowing. It's not the most easy thing in the world to determine the magnetic lines of flux and what their actual paths are. As a matter of fact, that's why most of us engineers that work with transformers and inductors, we like to stick with very well-known defined structures because, you know, we model these because we know what the toroid does, we know what the E-core does, we know what a PQ core does. We're very, very familiar with these magnetic fields and the lines of flux. When you start getting into abstract geometries, you basically have to start from ground zero to determine exactly how these things and the lines of force are coupling to. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I mailed to you an email a couple of hours ago to both you, John, and to Wesley, which is a set of modeling programs, which I think are freeware, I'm not sure about this, where it allows you to calculate, model, and do computer-generated graphics of where the magnetic field will flow in various shapes of materials under various conditions. When you get a chance, take a look at that email that I sent to you, Glenn. Go ahead.
I didn't receive it, Dick.
I didn't receive it as well.
I sent it to Wesley. I sent it to kc2wgb@arorail.net. Is that a valid email address for you, John?
No, Dick. I'm jd500@aol.com.
Okay, you're Juliet Delta 500 or Oscar@arorail.com, did you say?
AOL.com, yes. J, D like in boy, 500@AOL.com.
Okay, Juliet Bravo 5, Oscar@arorail.com. Is that true, John?
Negative. AOL.com. AOL.
Gotcha. AOL.com. All righty. I'll resend it to you. Wesley got it. And Glenn, did you get it? Because I used the exact email address that you sent something to me Glenn. Over to you, Glenn.
Yes, Dick, I have it here. I'm looking at it. I've used this one before. And, no, they work very, very well. Sometimes the downside to some of these programs are that they're for very specific structures that are well known. And when you get outside the standard structures, you know, as I said, you might be starting from ground zero. You might have to write your own program. But generally for like the standard ones, like, you know, E-core geometries and, you know, toroidal geometries used in the, how could I say, the textbook fashion, they work very, very well. KC2QIQ.
Question.
Okay, by way of those modeling programs, at least he stands a chance if he happens to fall into one of the classic case. You got it, Wesley.
Like about a month ago, I was beating on something that was very strangely pointed. I lost. There was somebody better than me. Okay, there was a core, and on the core, you had a very narrow coils, like a pancake, winded in zigzag fashion. I don't have a proper wording. So they were very narrow and very tall. Now, then there was a spacing between this and the next coil, exactly the same as the width of the coil. Now, The outer wind of each one of the pancake was at least twice of the diameter of the first wind of that pancake. And there was like a section of 30 or 40 of this. And then inside there was three bars of the ferrite made like a triangle, but they were like a three cylinders stick together, so it created sort of triangles, and they were mechanically driven inside a coil, so you could pull it in and push it out. I still do not understand what was the reason, instead of winding this coil the typical way, even if with few layers, why did they went this way? Back to you, Dick.
First of all, something happening in my life. I'm going to have to leave you guys at midnight. And I heard the words. I did not get the picture of those pancake windings. I didn't get that picture. I think it's going to require some kind of a graphic that's mailed to us, Wesley. This was TechNet number 1319 of the series. And I'm going to have to leave you guys. Bye-bye for now. And what's the easiest way you can show us a diagram of what you just described, Wesley? Go ahead.
Philip John is the one who would be able to explain that. The typical coil that is winded with, let's say, 3 millimeters or 4 millimeters width, but it's winded the layer under after layer, and it's like zigzag fashion. John, pick up.
I'm not sure, Wesley. I'm not sure the one you're describing, and Dick has to go. So, and I'm going to save my question for next week. But he's got to go. Let's let him go.
When you said zigzag winding, is that the way that they wind lacing coil onto a roll?
Correct.
Okay. There's lots of RF chokes that are wound that way for the reason of lowering the amount of capacitance between the turns. And a 2.5 millihenry RF choke is wound as a series of about 5 or 7 pancakes, and each pancake is wound with the zigzagging as if it was a lacing cord. That's to lower the capacitance between the turns.
I see. So they put like 20 of them with exactly the same spacing as the width of each one of these windings, and they drive the three rods stick together like a triangle or ferrite together.
John, I bet you remember what an old-fashioned 2.5 millihenry RF choke looks like. It's about 4 or 5 pancake windings, and each winding is zigzagged like a like lacing cord. Over to you, John.
Oh, absolutely, Dick. I've seen a lot of those, worked on a lot of those, and some of them were wound on what looked like a long resistor body. They were, Millen used to make a lot of those. Very, very big time they were. I remember them in the 60s even. I don't know if they went beyond that much.
And maybe that's what Wesley is describing. I'll have to see you guys next week. Bye-bye for now.
73
is
Dick, catch down the log,
KC2QIQ. 73 is Dick. And it sort of reminds me of the way kite string was wound, KC2WGP.
73 Dick, thank you very much. Glenn, what do you think was the reason for it? So many coils on one form, and inside inserted the ferrite material that could be pulled in and out. Back to you.
Well, generally when you have a lot of windings, they're usually arranged so that they couple from winding to winding in a very specific way. And the ferrite going in and out the center is basically just to create the an increase in permeability so that you get a little bit of reinforcement in the coupling from winding to winding. So I would imagine that's the reason. I haven't seen the structure, but if you want to send the some print or email of the structure to me, I can take a look at it and analyze it.
Okay, I'm going to take the email from John, or you can find my email on the QRZ.com. Send me just your email, and I'm going to be able to email you the picture. I believe that I still have it.